Jocelyn Benson is the dean of Wayne State University's law school. She is also the founder and executive director of the Michigan Center for Election Law. Benson was the Democratic nominee for Michigan's Secretary of State in 2010. She is also the founder and president of Military Spouses of Michigan and the author of the book State Secretaries of State, Guardians of the Democratic Process. Jocelyn Benson, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off by talking about legislative districts and how they're drawn, the gerrymandering, as it's called, by some, including State Representative Sean McCann, whose candidacy for state Senate you're here in part to help support. If you could have a blank slate here and say we're going to have a new process for drawing these districts, what would it be?
I think any process that allows citizens to draw the lines or involves citizens in drawing the lines is one that has more integrity than the process we have now, where essentially legislators are drawing their own districts or the districts of their friends running for Congress or another legislative office. And that system is rife with conflicts of interest and politics. And in reality, it should be one when we're talking about representation where citizens have as much input as possible. Right now in Michigan, they don't have any input.
How much can you limit politics for a process which is fraught with politics? Because ultimately, the way boundaries are drawn is going to determine, to a certain extent, which parties win in what parts of the state.
Yes. And the challenge with the democratic process and election law generally is this question of how do you enforce and who should enforce the rules of the game to make them fair? And there are a lot of states that have done citizen-led redistricting where citizens are drawing the lines, like California, Iowa. When you have states in which citizens are more involved in the structure, you find that for the most part, it's more fair than at least what we have now, where those deepest and most entrenched in the partisan process are those who have control over, in this case, the drawing of the lines, or in other cases, sometimes enforcing election law. And so it's a really, you know, from an objective standpoint, it's fascinating to think about how the rules of the game are interpreted and enforced by those who benefit or, you know, have a benefit of the interpretation one way or the other. But the further away we can get from that, the better, although we all acknowledge that it'll be hard to ever reach a sort of perfect system where bias is completely removed.
The Washington Post had a story this week about both parties now targeting Secretary of State races in states across the country, including Michigan. Of course, you have run for Secretary of State yourself. Regardless of maybe the morality or the ethics of trying to influence election outcomes that way, is that an effective way of doing it, get your person in there at the Secretary of State position?
Well, what history shows is certainly that, which is, you know, in the 2000 election, you had one Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, in Florida, making decisions that impacted the outcome of whether there would be a recount and the outcome of an entire presidential election. We saw that in 2004 in Ohio with Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State at the time, making decisions about what type of voter registration forms were acceptable. So undoubtedly, Secretaries of State have a significant role in influencing, making day-to-day decisions that alter or impact the system of elections and democracy itself. And so it's no surprise that we're seeing parties trying to game the system in the way that parties can try to game campaigns and elections, but it's still wrong. And particularly, and this is on both sides of the spectrum, many objective analysts would argue that the Secretary of State position should be a nonpartisan position. And when I ran, I pledged to take an oath of nonpartisan partisanship, which colleagues and secretaries of state in other states have done successfully to avoid questions of partisanship and impropriety.
But even if the position were to be nonpartisan, people who identify as Republicans and Democrats would be running for that job.
Yes.
Again, I guess we come back to that question of who's our umpire here that
Absolutely.
Tells us it's a ball or a strike?
When I wrote the book 2010 on the Secretary of State's office and how they can perform best as guardians of the democratic process, I found that it really just gets down to the person who is in that position and their personal commitment to doing the right thing. And that person can be a Republican or Democrat, but they must have that connection to integrity. And then when you ask how can a person like that get in office, it's up to the voters to really demand that type of Secretary of State. I talked to, when I was doing research for the book, several openly partisan secretaries of states on both sides, in which they said, look, I'm partisan. The voters selected me, so that must be what they want. And the other side is where you had secretaries of state who were Republican or Democrat on the ballot, but who sought a nonpartisan role. And they said that they were selected by the voters in their states, Kentucky, Washington, and others, to perform a nonpartisan role. So at the end of the day, my conclusion was, regardless of the party, regardless of the system, it's up to the individual Secretary of State and the voters who choose them to demand that type of nonpartisanship.
And is there a way of getting that message across to voters that's effective, that this should be what the voters want, and here's how you get it?
It's a challenge, especially when voters have so few avenues to access information that is not filtered through campaigns. And on top of that, you have so many campaigns out there, in addition to secretaries of state, attorney general, governor, Senate, that are filling the airwaves with chatter about how to vote and information. So it's hard in that for voters to actually get information about a secretary of state candidate, and they really have to seek it out. But they can seek it out. And my hope, although I'm not expecting this, but my hope is that the extra attention that both parties are paying to the Secretary of State races this year will amplify the discussion so that voters are going to take a closer look at who they're selecting for these offices.
The Center for Election Law, Michigan Center for Election Law, mm-hmm. which you founded at Wayne State University, spent a lot of Election Day 2012 responding to complaints about voting machines which had broken down. Mm-hmm. Of course, people will remember that was the day we saw long lines mm-hmm. outside many polling places. Mm-hmm. In a country which considers itself sort of the epicenter of democracy, mm-hmm. the way it's supposed to be done, how do we address the issue of voting machines breaking down and having people standing in line for hours at a time just to cast a ballot?
It requires election administrators, clerks, and secretaries of state to be proactive in trying to avoid problems before they occur. And too often we don't see that for many different reasons. But the nonprofit sector has really risen in its role to try to avoid those problems in the absence of government working to do that. So our organization partners with clerks to try to, and we did this in 2012, get extra voting booths or fix machines when they're broken, or train poll workers to fix machines. And that's one thing that Wayne State Law School is looking at partnering with some clerks and doing, is actually having better poll worker training so that on election day, those in the polls are able to fix what and address any problem that occurs. With long lines in 2012, a lot of it was around confusion of the citizenship checkbox, whether or not you should reaffirm your citizenship like we do when we register to vote when you get your ballot. And that caused some confusion as well. But the most important thing we can do to minimize lines and long lines on election day is better poll worker training.
Do we also face a problem here that we don't really have a national election in the United States? We have 50 separate state elections. And in some ways, we really have more than that, because when you break it down by each county and each precinct, there can be different laws that govern how voting is done at a very local level. Does that create part of the problems that we saw on Election Day 2012?
It does. What you have is a very decentralized process, so that where you live ultimately can determine whether or not your vote will count. And there have been lots of studies that have showed, particularly in low-income areas, urban areas, voters may find that their ballots, even if cast, are less likely to count because of machine errors and things like that, and just inequities in funding for administration at the local level. And then when you take that up to the federal level, you can even see differences state to state in terms of a voter's experience in a very stark way. Some states allow voters to vote up to a week or 2 weeks before election day. Here in Michigan, you have to vote on election day or sign something saying you'll be out of town so that you can vote absentee. We're one of the more restrictive states in that regard. Most states allow absentee voting before election day without any need to say why you're voting absentee. We don't have that in Michigan.
Would you like to see that change here?
Certainly, yeah. I think Michigan should join the majority of other states in this country in allowing citizens to vote absentee, allowing citizens to register to vote online. It saves a lot of money and improves the accuracy of our voter lists. And certainly early voting should be an option. People are busy, and if they are available to vote or prepared to vote on the Saturday before the election in person, they should have every opportunity to do that.
Are there other changes you would like to see in terms of voter registration or when people are allowed to vote?
Well, I think the voter registration process and the timing of that has to be looked at. Right now, you have to register to vote by paper. You have to fill out a piece of paper and send it in 30 days before the election. And particularly for students or really any voter, sometimes someone doesn't decide to vote until 20 days before an election, or they're not paying attention until then, and then they try to register and it's too late. Other states allow citizens to register to vote a week before Election Day or closer to or even on Election Day. So something like that would, I think, get us closer to our goal of enabling more people to participate and ultimately ensuring the outcome of our elections are as accurate as possible.
There was recently a school millage election in this part of the state, Gull Lake. The vote initially showed that a bond proposal there had failed by 5 votes. Then a recount was requested, and it revealed that some absentee ballots were spoiled. That changed the outcome of the election, and the millage actually passed by 3 votes. Now, there's a few interesting things that came up here. One of them was that the reason these votes were counted by the clerk in Richland was that they had circled their yes or no, had not filled in the circle that they're supposed to. They actually circled a word. So they felt the voter intent was clear. Now, this, however, would not have been discovered if there had not been a recount in the first place. So I guess I'm wondering, should we be concerned that other elections, we have these errors going on and they're happening, and yet we just may not know because no one requests a recount?
Yes, it's very likely that most elections contain some sort of wrinkle, like the one that emerged here with some ballots not being counted. And in fact, in any given election, I would estimate at least 1% of ballots are spoiled or for some reason not counted. And that can affect the outcome of the election. So the work really has to be done before the vote is cast to make sure that the voter knows how to cast a vote properly and demonstrate their intent. But Michigan allows for, if there's a recount, for ballots to be counted by hand, and if the intent of the voter is clear, and even if it wasn't picked up by a machine, that vote can count for the election, and that's what you saw here. But that said, there are a lot of imperfections in our system of counting ballots and processing voters' votes, and those imperfections sometimes are not relevant, perhaps, because the outcome of the election is so vast and the difference between the votes so great. But in close elections, as we saw in the 2000 presidential election, and as you saw locally here, and as we see, frankly, in almost every election day has some story like this, it does make a difference. And that's why we have to do everything we can to make sure that voters' will is expressed in every way and counted properly in every way possible.
Michigan has a pretty strict law on voter intent. As the county clerk, Tim Snow, said here, really, we're not a voter intent state. You have to fill out your ballot correctly. Of course, one of the things that also plays into the role here is that it's an absentee ballot. At the polling place, it would have caught it in the machines that we use here. But in any event, I guess I'm wondering from your standpoint, is that the right approach, that it's a pretty strict, you got to fill out the ballot correctly? Or should we allow for someone to try and figure out what voter intent was if we can do that?
Well, Michigan law actually does allow for voter intent to carry the day in determining the vote of a legitimate ballot. There are other states like Illinois that say and this would be a sort of not a voter intent state, if it'll specifically say their X has to be crossed or the bubble has to be fully completed in order for the vote to count. So there are other states that have even more stricter requirements in that regard than Michigan. And then there are other states that are even more flexible than Michigan. So we kind of fall in the middle. But in general, I think the law should be interpreted in a way that that does reflect and ensure where it can be determined the will of the voter is what is reflected in the voting rolls. And sometimes when we get focused on the nitty gritty, we lose sight of the overall goal of an election, which is for eligible voters to come together and choose, make a decision. And when we find flaws in that process or find that the government is unable to determine what the voter's decision accurately is, then we do have to make some changes. And I think there are a lot of changes in that regard that need to come to Michigan.
Tell us a little bit about Military Spouses of Michigan.
Well, my husband's in the Army. He enlisted a few years ago, and he is currently overseas. And what I found, having a job in Michigan and so not being able to travel with him to different locations as easily as other spouses might, that there are a lot of spouses in Michigan who are married to someone in the military or love someone in the military. And when those individuals are deployed or go off to an active duty station, there is a need for folks to come together and support each other, because there are a lot of very unique experiences that we have on the military spouse in the military spouse community. So I started the Military Spouses of Michigan in 2012 with four other spouses or partners of someone in the military. And we found instantly, almost overwhelmingly, there was such a need for an organization that would just provide support, free legal services, access to childcare, and different things that spouses need. And we've seen in the past few years everything from spouses who were fired from their jobs because they wanted to visit their husband on deployment leave and they weren't permitted to, and that type of thing was against the law, and so we were able to support and get that spouse support, to a need for our laws to be updated to enable more spouses to work while they're married to someone who's active duty, to a whole other host of issues where you have LGBT partners in the military, and during the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, there are even more needs now of that community. So we try to be a source of connecting spouses across the state and partners across the state, and building that community that we don't have in Michigan. And it's been a wonderful joy to be a part of the organization, and certainly also a source of support for me.
And, you know, we've got people deployed and still in places, Afghanistan and other spots around the world. Is this a need which has been growing over the last several years?
Certainly. I mean, we're now at the end, or nearing the end, of a 10-year or more war that we've had individuals, men and women, serving on the front lines of. And so we have a whole new generation of veterans that need to, and that we have a responsibility to, reintegrate into civilian life. And on top of that, their spouses, their children. The best way we can at this point, I guess, address the impact of war on this generation that has been fighting is to ensure the reintegration of our military veterans as easy as possible. And it's been quite disheartening to have a front row seat to see how seldom we're actually doing that well as a state and as a country, whether it's helping veterans find jobs, access to health care, even to address injuries that they received or that perhaps their spouses incurred in the line of duty. We are, in my view, woefully unprepared, frankly, as a country and as a state to embrace this community. And it's a community that we must embrace if we're going to not just do the right thing, but if we're going to truly protect and serve those who protect and serve us.
As I noted at the beginning, you were the Democratic nominee for Michigan Secretary of State in 2010. Mm-hmm. Last year, for a while, you were mentioned as a possible candidate for Congress, ultimately decided you were not going to run.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a political future at some point down the road for Jocelyn Benson?
Well, I'm really happy leading Wayne State Law School right now. We just, for the first time in several decades, broke into the top 100 law schools in the country, and we're now ranked 87 and tied with Michigan State for the in the rankings for the second place law school in the state behind University of Michigan. So we are, I'm very proud of really the educational opportunities we've been able to provide in training the next generation of lawyers and leaders in this state through Wayne Law. So I'm happy there right now. But I'm always eager to have a great impact on these issues and the ones that we've talked about. And I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done in Michigan to ensure our citizens have the government they deserve. And I'm committed to doing that work however I can in the future.
Will you be on the ballot for anything in 2014?
No, I'm not intending to run for anything in 2014. I'm happy where I'm at right now.
But possibly another year.
We'll see what the future brings.
Jocelyn Benson, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jocelyn Benson is the dean of Wayne State University's Law School. She was also the Democratic nominee for Michigan Secretary of State in 2010. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.